Hello, I'm Anna Maria Caruzzi, and welcome to this series of podcasts on interdisciplinarity. Bridging across methods and models in the biosciences is brought to you by the Systems Toxicology Unit of the JRC EU Reference Laboratory for Alternatives to Animal Testing. Today I'm joined by Blanca Rodriguez, Professor of Computational Medicine at the University of Oxford. Blanca's research is groundbreaking in advancing computational modeling techniques into cardiology. She has many accolades and is a fellow or board member of many prestigious organizations that would take far too long for me to list. Her research team has twice won the NC3ARDS Prize for research that is, and I quote, outstanding and original and could have major impacts on the replacement, reduction, or refinement of the use of animals in research. Welcome, Blanca, and thank you for being on our podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Anna Maria. I'm really, really excited about this conversation.
Blanca, could you tell me, when did you first realize that in order to make progress with your computational methods, you needed to be interdisciplinary with experimentalists and clinicians?
So I'm an engineer by background, and when I studied engineering, I didn't have any formal training in biomedicine at all. It was all electronics and machines. So it was through a talk that I became really interested in computational modeling of the heart. And for many years during my PhD and even postdoctoral training, I only used data from the literature, experimental data from the literature, rather than actually seeing the experiments. And it was at some point that I realized that I was missing out very valuable information about how the experiments were performed and also the information content in the raw experimental data. So I really engage with experimentalists in trying to understand the techniques that are used to gather the data and how those techniques could have a great importance in the interpretation of the experimental data we were using for computational modeling.
And can you tell me a little bit about how did you find that collaboration? Was it easy? Did you find resistance? How did it work out for you?
So it was a challenge. It's always a challenge. And the first challenge is in establishing effective communication through language that can be understood by both parties. But more than anything, it was also about the definition of goals that were interesting to both parties, to the experimentalist and the modelers. So very often experimentalists and later clinicians wanted us, computational scientists, to do analysis of their data to do service work. And that wasn't particularly interesting to us. We wanted to develop new computational approaches. So it was through conversations to discussions that we were able to define goals that were of interest to both worlds, that were novel for the experimentalists and the physiologists, but that were also novel for us and interesting to us computational scientists.
So how did you find was the process of defining common goals? Was it something easy to achieve? What kinds of things are involved in it?
So it's certainly not easy. It's not trivial at all. And it's an area in which I invested a substantial amount of work and effort in establishing those collaborations. So, for example, in one of my first collaborations, I wanted to engage with a very established professor and that had access to a lot of human data. And that was very important to me because I wanted our team to build human models, human-based models. So the first thing he did was to give me a grilling. He asked me a lot of questions to assess whether I was worth his time. So the busier people are, the more complicated it is to find the time to have those conversations. So he really, and the collaboration, so he really wanted to know whether I had taken the time to learn about physiology and experimental techniques and whether I knew exactly how I was going to be using the data if he spent time in collaborating with us. So The first thing, as I said, he gave me a grilling, and then when he established that I was worth his time, then I knew enough, and I knew what I wanted to do with those data. Then we established the trust that is needed for the collaboration, and I'm still collaborating to these days. But the first thing was to establish that trust through knowledge and through clarity about what the data were going to be used for.
So it seems to me that you established these grounds for trust in the first instance. You had to learn about his world, about this potential collaborator's world, and take the trouble to do that. And so, and in that way, he could see that it would be worthwhile spending his time with you, investing time in this collaboration. So that trust, that establishing of trust, it actually almost comes before your first conversation with your potential collaborator. It comes in the background work that you have to do as you approach that conversation.
Yes, indeed. So it's really important to do the homework before going to a meeting, especially when you're asking people to give you data, and data are time-consuming to gather, even if they are already available, even if the experiments have been performed. Obtaining the data, copying the data, and also all the information that is needed to understand the data takes time. So people need to know that that effort is going to be compensated somehow. And for that, one needs to be prepared to demonstrate that they are trustworthy.
So that's really interesting, that, you know, how much goes into preparing the ground for the collaboration. Another thing that I'd like to ask is, when during the process of the collaboration, how much do you adapt to each other? So how much do you adapt what you had in mind to do, depending on who your collaborator is, and how much do they adapt to you? Do they change their research questions? What kinds of dialogue is there, and how much adaptation to each other? Do you have any experience? I'm sure that you do have experiences of those. Can you share one of those with us?
Yeah, so hopefully things change through the conversation. So we get, we adapt the research questions for sure. So yes, certainly the goals need to change through those conversations. It's a negotiation process, and one that becomes very rich when different worlds get together, like in the context of experimental and computational research. So as an example, when I became interested in understanding variability, so understanding rather than the average data set, understanding what explain differences in different data points. So for example, the data that came from a human population, the average behavior was the one reported in the literature, but what we wanted to understand is what was the variability in that human population, for example, or in a set of experiments. So initially, the experimentalists were very reluctant to give us the raw data and all the data points, because in their world, variability was a bad thing. It was very much related to seen to be related to experimental error and how the experimental techniques introduce noise in the experiments or in the data. So I really had to work really hard to convince the experimentalists to give me the raw data. And in some sense, I did it by telling them that that variability was present in data from many different laboratories. So it wasn't that their particular data sets were more variable. It was there in all laboratories. So they gave me the raw data because they also trusted me that I was going to do the right thing, that rather than reporting a huge amount of variability that might be related to experimental error, I was going to demonstrate that it was coming from a physiological explanation. And also that, and they gave me the data because they trusted that I was going to do something constructive with them. And I was very clear about the goals. But also it was very important in my collaborations with industry, and especially pharma industry, where people in safety pharmacology, they were trying to explain and predict adverse outcomes of drugs. And those don't happen in the average person. They happen in people who have disease conditions and have slightly abnormal pathophysiology. So it was very important to learn from the experimental data what could explain that variability and use that information for our collaborations in industry and the identification or prediction of adverse outcomes of drugs. And this research question about variability and drug effects really was shaped through collaborating with pharma partners and also experimentalists. And we really put together a very rich research group where we could have interesting conversations across disciplines and across methodologies.
So it sounds to me that working together in this way, you are able to find new research questions of interest to both of you. In the interdisciplinary collaboration, there is something that was not predicted at the outset of your collaboration, which is what we really want the most fruitful kinds of interdisciplinary collaborations to be, have these kinds of features. And can you tell me, what are there any particular challenges in terms of collaborating, not only within academia, but outside academia, with clinicians, with people in pharma? Are there any particular challenges that come with that?
So in terms of our work in academia versus work in industry or clinical work, the main difference for me is the freedom to operate. So in industry, any project needs to be approved by management, whereas for me and in academia in general, we have much more freedom in terms of the research we want to do. We depend on funding and resources, but the research questions are the ones we set. So in industry, they need to get approval from management when they engage in a research project. And the clinical work is, of course, very much limited by ethical considerations, and that makes it also more challenging. In terms of collaborating with industry, one aspect that I really value and I learned a lot about is the need to have a very clear agreement on what is the research, what is the data transfer, what are the goals, what are the outcomes that are expected. And all of this is written in an agreement that is usually approved at the university level. And I think that clarity is really important and very, very beneficial. So I have actually implemented it in my academic collaborations as well, maybe not so much as an official agreement, but as a document we can refer to in terms of the collaboration, where the goals are very clear and where the expected outcomes are also very clear. It provides a clarity that makes the collaboration much easier and that avoids future problems as well.
Thank you. So that's really interesting. I find it so interesting that you're actually using processes that come from industry in your academic research as well, and that is beneficial in your academic research as well. I wonder if you can tell me, if you take a step back a little bit, looking at how your now very successful career in this area and all of these collaborations, where have you met the most challenge to proceeding in an interdisciplinary way? For example, were your colleagues in academia always on board with the interdisciplinary scope of your research, or the kinds of paths that your research sometimes took in order to reach these kinds of compromises or these arrangements with other disciplines and other sectors?
So yes, there is always a tension. The first tension is in our own departments that are based on specific disciplines. For example, mine is computer science, there is mathematics, physics, and we are assessed in terms of those disciplines for promotion, for research assessment exercises. So There are people who think they have who think that they hold the truth about what computer science is, for example, and they are prepared to judge whether a particular research topic is within the remit of the department or not. And it is very important to be able to argue about it, about the importance of interdisciplinarity in that context. The second tension is also in funding panels, where research proposals that are interdisciplinary are assessed by panels where panel members have different expertise. And I've seen a lot of tension in that regard, especially when a particular discipline was overrepresented. So, for example, in panels where most panel members were biologists and only a few had computational expertise, then it was much more difficult to fund computational proposals. And in that context, it's really important to have a really good management of the committee and have a chair that really understands the issues around interdisciplinarity.
Right, that's really enlightening, and it helps us to get a better grip on why it is in the broader context that interdisciplinary projects can have a kind of a more difficult trajectory. So now, as you think about your career, can I ask you what is the one piece of advice that you would give a young researcher who is setting out on their research career and considering going interdisciplinary?
So the first thing for me, the primary aspect to consider is communication. Communication in terms of finding a common language, but very importantly, in understanding where the other person is coming from. What is their world? How are they thinking? When you present the result, the research to them, what are their thought processes? How are they perceiving it from their world? So that communication of being able, of course, so that understanding of where the audience is coming from is really important to shape the way your research is communicated. So for certain, that's where I spend a lot of time training my own more junior colleagues and making sure that communication is effective, because it's the basis for everything else, for establishing common goals, for giving a very good presentation about the research, for writing really good grant proposals that are understood by a variety of people coming from different disciplines. So communication is crucial.
Thank you so much, Blanca, for making it clear how those communication skills are quite broad. They're not simply a matter of being able to speak well, but they are quite broad, and they take into account this needing to be able to understand the perspective of the other person. So thank you very much for joining me for this podcast, and I think that many young researchers out there are going to take many useful and valuable messages from you.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
So what comes out very strongly for me in this discussion with Blanca is how important it is to build up trust with potential interdisciplinary collaborators. Yes, communication skills are a part of that. But this is not only about being able to have the conversations and the interactions. It's also about doing your homework, taking the trouble to find out about other people, what they are doing, what their world is, trying to get their perspective and enter into their perspective. And that takes a lot of time. Time here really is of the essence. Finding out enough about your potential collaborators' world so that you're not wasting their time by not doing your homework first, but also don't underestimate the time that it takes to establish and sustain a deeply interdisciplinary line of research that comes up with unpredictable and novel and valuable results. Another important takeaway point is how cross-sector collaborations are as much about processes of research than about doing the research, and how adopting organizational processes, such as setting out an agreement of work, can be clarifying for the research to be carried out.
Thank you for listening to this series of podcasts on interdisciplinarity. I hope that it has given some new insights on what it is like to be an interdisciplinary researcher, and I hope that we will meet again soon.